Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In the 1950s, American Indians experienced some of the worst social and economic conditions of any group in the United States. And it was at this time, when the very future of Indian people in this country was in doubt, that Congress announced the policy known as termination. It would mean the sell-off of tribal lands, the withdrawal of federal support, and the rapid assimilation of Indian people into the majority American society. It was also at this time, seemingly against all odds, that Indian leaders organized to fight the termination policy, and the result was what we now recognize as the modern tribal sovereignty movement. Our guest for the show this morning to talk about this story is Charles Wilkinson. He is one of the country's leading experts on Indian law. He's professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he also specializes in federal public land law. And he is the author of a book that was published a couple of years ago that tells the story. The title of his book is Blood Struggle, The Rise of Modern Indian Nations. So I'm sure if you're interested in reading the book, you can go out and find it. It's published by W.W. Norton. And he's joining us this morning by telephone to talk about it. Just a little bit more about him before joining the faculty of the law school there at University of Colorado. He practiced law with private firms in Phoenix and San Francisco, and then with the Native American Rights Fund. In 1975, he became a law professor, and he taught at the law schools of the University of Oregon, Michigan, and Minnesota before moving to Colorado. That was in 1987. As we talk, questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along, get in as many callers as possible, but people are certainly welcome into the conversation. If you are listening in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and the call's on us, and that is 800-222-9455. Slightly different. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455 at any point here. If you want to give us a call, you certainly should feel welcome to do that. Professor Wilkinson, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
I think just to set the stage, as you do in the book, I should give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about what conditions were like for Native Americans at around the time we're talking about. That when the termination policy was announced, this was 1953. So in the early 1950s, what was life like for Indian people in this country?
Well, you know, it's almost unimaginable for those of us in the majority society. Unemployment was at 60%. It had been that way for three quarters of a century since they'd been moved onto smaller reservations. You couldn't find more than two or three tribes that would have, let's say, two college graduates. Most Indian people finished up elementary school or a bit beyond that. Health conditions were terrible, and the Indianness was being stripped away. Their identity was being demeaned and had been for so long, so that Indian children were and adults were in a period of forced assimilation. The old dances and songs were prohibited. Children were sent to boarding schools where their long hair was cut off, weren't permitted to speak their languages, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs ran the reservations. Indian tribes, ever since Chief Justice John Marshall and ever since we treated with tribes, signed formal treaties with them, had been recognized as sovereigns, but That was a fiction by the 1950s in the real world of Indian country, where the Bureau of Indian Affairs had a heavy hand. And, you know, going back to that time, I still haven't found a reservation where there was any indoor plumbing, any paved roads in the neighborhoods, or electricity in the homes. It was really rudimentary. It was, as I say, beyond the imagination of most of us.
Hmm. Well, given the fact that things were that bad, would you say that it was the case that whatever minimal kind of support that Indian people received from the federal government, that even if that was taken away, even if it was minimal, would it have made things even that much worse?
Well, Indians are land-based peoples, and as you accurately stated, termination was going to call for a sell-off of the tribal lands, and really taking away the basis of their culture. And those tribes that were terminated, with the land gone, most of them just disappeared off into the cities or other places, away from their homes. And so, yes, termination would have been, and was for those tribes who were terminated, a horrible thing and a direct attempt. I mean, termination, Congress, the leaders in Congress who were behind it, meant termination literally, that we were just going to do away with Indian societies using any means we could, short of violence. Mm-hmm.
And so there, that I think is an important point here. What we are talking about was this, the ultimate goal here was complete assimilation of Native Americans, and it's something that, as you say, had really been an objective of Indian policy previous, but this would be the and I suppose some people even have used a term like final solution to apply to termination.
Exactly.
This there were a number of people, I'm sure, in Congress that were driving this, but perhaps there was one person more than anybody else who was the leader on this, and this was a senator from Utah. His name was Arthur Watkins, and what's very striking here is that he, and I'm sure that other people, the way they talked about it, they talked about it as if this was a good thing, was a very positive thing. Senator Watkins actually made a connection between termination and emancipation of slaves at the time of the Civil War, and that there was this idea, this belief, apparently, of supporters of termination that this would be good for Native Americans.
Well, that's right, and I think it's understandable, because if you went out to reservations, which not many people did, it was intolerable. It was poverty at its most extreme, and you could almost physically see the way the Bureau of Indian Affairs was clamping everything down, was just a wet blanket. And so, particularly in a time when, after World War II, the country was really taking off and individual initiative was so much the ideal and the reality, that you looked at these people who were under the thumb of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and yes, you could free them. And Watkins, not so immodestly, I think, compared himself to Abraham Lincoln by saying that you would see written over the heads of American Indians, "These people shall be free." And so it resonated. And at that time, it's less true today, Indian policy was really a back eddy in Congress, and so one or two people and an administration inclined to do this could work kind of in the dark even, and certainly, as you're saying, the policy seemed reasonable. It seemed that it was in the benefit of Indians, and of course, the one thing that nobody made connected the dots was, well, why would that mean you'd have to sell off all their land?
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't make sense, but that connection wasn't made.
Well, was there some degree to which some individuals' desire to have that land was driving this policy?
Yes, there was some of that, and you know, one reservation, it was one of the two largest to be terminated, was the Menominee Reservation up north of you in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous country, and great opportunities for second homes, and also it was heavily timbered. And so you had interests, yes, who wanted to acquire some of that land. In Oregon, the Klamath Reservation, 800,000 acres, was first-rate ponderosa pine country, and the timber companies wanted a shot at it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Charles Wilkinson. He's professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he specializes in both federal public land law and Indian law, and has written widely on both subjects. If you're interested in reading some more of the story here that we're talking about, you can look for his book, published in 2005, Blood Struggle, The Rise of Modern Indian Nations. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, during the roughly 11-year period when this policy was in effect, when termination was going on, more than 100 tribes were terminated. And I think that, as you mentioned, the biggest, or at least in terms of their land holdings, would have been the Menominee, the Klamath, and perhaps also the Ute. And you certainly spend a significant amount of time here talking in the book about the effect on these people of a termination. What were some of the results?
Well, health problems got more serious. The Indian Health Service was rudimentary, but still provided a baseline. And so, the place where it's been studied the most is Menominee. And so in that case, there was the old reservation, the former reservation, became Menominee County, and there wasn't a single doctor or dentist in the county. The children were sent into white schools and faced discrimination, which, again, the BIA schools were not good, and so I'm not sure things were worse, but the discrimination was well documented. Poverty increased at Menominee and the other terminated tribes, and there was just a sense of wrong that developed. And the Menominee Reservation, I mean, gosh, the Wolf River runs down through the middle of it. It was one of the original wild and scenic rivers. It's absolutely magnificent country, and here it is now, owned by a state corporation. It was a complicated situation. In that the land was not immediately sold off, but it was owned by a state corporation, but they had to pay taxes on the land, and tribal land, like all government land, is not taxable, but now it was. They had an outmoded mill. They were losing money, and so they started to sell off heartland. It really happened fairly quickly when the Menominees were restored in 1973, under the leadership of Ada Deer, who was the tribal chair at the time, but the entire tribe was behind it, behind restoration. And it became actually a story that I think was quickly understood by people in Wisconsin and then on Capitol Hill as to just the human impacts, that some measurable, but also the loss of culture, the loss of land, was really palpable, and Congress acted quite quickly in the 70s, really considering how complex the situation was, to restore the tribes. The bill was introduced in early 72 and then passed in late 73.
So just to put termination in some kind of perspective, I think people would be aware of just how much to that point, to up to 1950, let us say, that Native Americans lost. Was termination a significant kind of tipping point, and that if it had not been reversed, then we wouldn't be talking about Native Americans the way that we do today?
Absolutely. And tribes, and you know, this is really the I suppose the central theme in Blood Struggle, is that the tribes have made a really inspiring and remarkable revival since the 1950s that we've been talking about. Mm. And today, tribes Land bases are increasing. They are the real governments in Indian country. And, you know, Indian people, Indian tribes today own 58 million acres. That's larger than Minnesota, almost as large as the state of Colorado when you combine all the reservation lands in the lower 48. And tribes are the real governments out there now, and termination by definition would not have allowed that. The land wouldn't be there, but in addition, there wouldn't be tribal governments to be the basic governments.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it the case that if you take a look at the kind of movement that arose in large part to try to fight termination and the idea behind it, that what happened really was forcing the United States government to honor previous agreements, that it was, in a sense, that, or was new law made or new law forged as a result?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, because termination, for all its horrors, and because of its horrors, really was the spark that made tribal leaders, Indian people, just look in the mirror and say, we've got to do something. But Vine Deloria Jr., who I think is maybe the single most important person in this era, and wrote a book called Custer Died for Your Sins, but has also been active in many, many different ways, just passed away last year. And Vine said, in the early 60s, he said, we better win this one, because if we don't, there won't be another one. And so termination caused Indian people to see it in those terms. And then, and this was something I didn't appreciate until I was fairly late in writing this book, and that's one thing that I think is so rewarding about writing a book, is how much you learn. I mean, you're putting down maybe things you knew beforehand for sure, but it's also an exploration. And what I came to realize was how profoundly important that Indian veterans from World War I and the Korean War were. And just for example, and I don't want to make too much of this, but I think it's true, is that Tom Brokaw had his book, The Greatest Generation, and I'm going to say that when you look at it closely in terms of what World War II veterans accomplished after World War II, one group that is just right in the front line of accomplishments are the Indian veterans. And They'd been overseas. They had been distinguished. Indians enlisted in World War II, as they have in other wars, larger than any other identifiable group in the country. And they'd done well, and they were honored, and they weren't discriminated against. They were treated as equals in the military. And they came home and saw that many states were denying them the right to vote, and discriminated against in other ways, and including the BIA's presence. And so you had this group of people who, A, weren't going to take it anymore, and B, understood the apparatus of the United States and how to deal with the United States. And on the reservations, I mean, the United States was still a foreign government. There was almost no understanding of how you might get the Bureau of Indian Affairs off the reservations and have tribes take over. The idea of what levers to pull, filing test cases, lobbying in Congress and with the Secretary of Interior, that was all foreign to tribes until this happened. And so combined with some young Indian intellectuals who, for the first time in the early 60s, we started having Indian people going to college in reasonably large numbers. You had two discrete groups, some veterans, of course, got a higher education also, that really started to stir the pot and began to make it such an exciting time for Indian people, for a time when they could be proud to be Indians, who could who could, as I say, go to the courts, go to Congress, and in a proud way explain what their rights were and how they ought to be honored, and many other things. But that basic dynamic, I think, was just very exciting.
Hmm. We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. They've been waiting patiently, so I will not make them wait any longer. Someone here in Urbana, I believe, Thomasboro, on our line number one here. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if you're aware of and could make a comment on all the Department of Defense research, testing, and military operations that's resulted in such catastrophic adverse health and environmental effects on tribal lands, for example, Pine Ridge with the Lakota Sioux and then the Four Corners with the Navajo, and the reluctance of the Department of Defense to clean it all up.
Yes. Was your name Warren, did I hear?
Oh, no. We don't ask people their name. I just said the caller was calling from the town of Thomasboro.
Okay. That's right. All right. Good. Yes, that was definitely part of it. And you mentioned Navajo, and I would include with that some other tribes in the Southwest in the Four Corners area, but particularly in Navajo. And you had two things going on there. You had uranium mining, and most of that uranium was going for military purposes, most of it being purchased by the federal government. And you had uranium miners who were not protected and were sent in there, and we clearly had very high mortality rates, and many of those mines have been abandoned but have not been cleaned up. And then secondly, you had testing, and the prevailing winds were such that a lot of those poisons came over to Navajo. And yes, there are other examples of that. And I think that there wasn't really a sense back then that there were really tribes out there, were really Indians out there. It was thought of as just kind of open land, maybe even thought of as public land, because the United States is a trustee and the Bureau of Indian Affairs is in the Department of Interior. And so it was, I think, just kind of thought of as wasteland that we can do with what we want to. And in some cases, it was the military up at Red Lake and Minnesota, they used part of the reservation as a bombing range without getting permission from anyone. At the Nisqually Reservation in Washington, Fort Lewis just took the reservation on the north side of the river without authority. And so, yes, that was one line of problems that the tribes were facing.
Did that get us your question? Okay. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580. And again, I should introduce our guest, Charles Wilkinson. He's professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder and specializes in both federal public land law and Indian law and has written extensively on both subjects. He's been an attorney in private practice. He also worked as an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, and after that became a professor of law and has taught at the law schools at University of Oregon, Michigan, and Minnesota before he went to Colorado in 1987. And if you're interested in reading some more on this particular subject we're talking about here, that is the termination movement in Congress started in the early 1950s, what that meant for Native Americans and how they organized to respond and how the modern tribal sovereignty movement really results. If you're interested in that story, it is the story that he explores in his book, Blood Struggle, The Rise of Modern Indian Nations. It is a book that was first published in hardcover in 2005, published by W.W. Norton. I'm sure you can find it in the library or in the bookstore. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I thought it was interesting that your point that Indian veterans, military veterans, were very important in the Indian rights movement. And it makes me think about the fact that in the civil rights movement for African Americans, also there, I think, veterans of both World Wars I and II were very important. Were there some connections, what were the connections between the Indian movement, movement for Indian rights, and the civil rights movement, that one particularly that was interested in civil rights for African Americans?
Yes, that's a very interesting set of connections, and I think it works on two levels. First, the civil rights movement at that time was heavily focused on eliminating segregation and allowing assimilation, but eliminating the separate status that was forced upon them. Tribes were trying to enforce the separate status. They had a different historical and legal situation. They were recognized as governments. They wanted to establish their governmental authority on the reservations, which they want and still want to be largely separate from the larger society. Now, I say largely separate. What they really mean is on their terms, that they want to make their own decisions as to how separate they're going to be. And so when you go to a modern tribal office building today, you're going to see plenty of computers and so forth, and of course a lot of children going off to college off the reservation, and so it's not some complete separatism, but it is separatism. And so the fundamental line of argument on and activism on the two sides was different. And the result was that you didn't have that much direct interaction between African-American leaders and tribal leaders. There was some, but not that much. And the tribes were also a bit wary of thinking they'd just get swallowed up in a larger movement and their distinctive issues would not get enough play. So they were, quote, different in that way. But at the same time, the civil rights movement was so strong at that time and resonated so strongly with the majority society, and there really was, with all the difficulties we know, but there really was a sense that African Americans had been wronged and that that ought to be changed. And so Congress was passing statutes, and we were seeing the whole apparatus of segregation being dismantled with generally a supportive public. And I understand in the South was being resistant. We understand that, but it was generally a supportive public. So that when the tribes became active in the 60s, A, they would borrow some of the techniques of the African-Americans, such as marches and sit-ins, and then also would just benefit from this large wave that was rolling out at that time. So I think that the civil rights movement was very important to Indian people, even though they weren't participating in the main thrust of it. It was their own movement that they developed.
Well, let's talk with somebody else here. This is somebody in the nearby community of Belgium, and this is our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question that seems pretty obvious to me, but I can't get it through my mind here. If these people were forced to give up their property, and this property was going to be purchased by, as you said, some lumbering or mining concerns or developmental concerns, what gave the government the right to give this land to these people and sell it? They weren't the obvious owners of it.
Yeah. Well, Congress has very broad authority over Indian affairs and clearly does have authority to sell tribal land or to purchase tribal land and sell it to somebody else. Now, you have to add to that Congress has the same power nationally over all lands. Congress can condemn and purchase your land or my land, or for that matter state land, and put it to some use, whether it's an interchange or an office building. And normally that's done with, in effect, with our consent, or at least a whole lot of input on our part. And if we learn that our land's going to be taken maybe and put into a federal park, let's say, that we're going to have a chance, along with other citizens, to really object to that and be sure also that we're paid fully if it is taken.
The question I have, sir, though, is if it's going to a private individual, which a mining company or a or a logging company is, why couldn't you just purchase your piece of land for more money than they're willing to give the federal government for it?
You mean the tribes would do it?
Yes, if you
they had no money.
Well, you said everybody had that. They have the right to do that over me. Well, yes, they do have that right to sell my property, but I have a right to bid on it just as much as the other person and bid more for my small little piece than that company would be willing to pay for it.
Yeah, no, that's right. But that doesn't help somebody who's poverty stricken and doesn't have a job.
Oh, okay.
And the tribes. You see, today, tribes are very substantial organizations today. We've got 70 tribes with over 90% of the membership of all Indian people in the country. 70 tribes who have governments of 300 or more employees. Most of those tribes are actually larger, their governments are, than the nearby county governments. Tribes have gotten to be that substantial. Back at this time that we're talking about now, and you raise a very good question about, the average Indian tribe would have one half or one employee. The Bureau of Indian Affairs was running the reservation, and the tribal budget didn't exist almost. It was almost a coffee can, so that the individuals didn't have the money to buy the land to outbid somebody, and neither did the tribes.
I see.
Really good question, but that's what it came down to.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Again, others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I guess there's something here that I'm still confused about, and perhaps justifiably, because I think that it is complicated. And that is, what exactly is the relationship between Indian tribes, in Indian individuals, and the government of the United States? Because Indian people are citizens of the United States, and at the same time, I'm not sure that the Constitution of the United States does it regard them in the same way that it does other U.S. citizens, or does it in a sense almost depend on what piece of land they happen to be standing on at the time?
As you say, it is complicated, but let me deal with the sovereignty part of it, and we could talk about other parts of it, but Indian tribes are governments, and we have in the United States, and we didn't learn it this way in school when you and I went, but it's more or less being taught broadly now, not everywhere, the understanding that there are three sources of sovereignty, of governmental authority in the United States of America. One is the federal government, the other is the states, and it has subdivisions, the states do, of counties and cities and towns. And then the third source of sovereignty is Indian tribes. And the United States has always recognized that, and that's why we made treaties. You make treaties. When you're dealing with another government, another sovereign, you make treaties. And the United States did that from the beginning. And it isn't making treaties with tribes anymore, but it continues to recognize that government-to-government relationship. And every federal agency now has a government-to-government policy of how tribes are treated specially according to their particular circumstances, and that they are governments. They can pass laws and regulate people within their boundaries. So that an Indian person has dual citizenship. Citizenship in their own tribe and citizenship in the United States. And the best answer to your question about what kind of citizenship do they have, the best answer, with really, I'm going to say no exceptions, is full citizenship in the United States and as United States citizens. And so, but they have dual citizenship. Now, the federal government is a trustee for Indian tribes, and that means it's a way of describing a dynamic we're all familiar with, which was at treaty time, the tribes needed protection. They were making a huge change in their way of life by becoming really subject to the laws of the United States and not just their own laws. And so the trust relationship has different ramifications. And, for example, can allow hiring of Indian people by race in the federal government in a time when racial classifications are so suspect. But what the reasoning of the courts are is that the government is not hiring a person by race. They are hiring a person who is a citizen of another government. And so just as we have some policies that affect Japanese and Irish and in terms of immigration and otherwise, the fact that they're treating them as citizens of another government is the basis for those hiring preferences.
Mm. You know, something else that I think it might be worth having you talk a little bit about goes back to what happened at the time when many of the treaties were signed, negotiated and signed between various tribes and the United States. And I think that we have often been led to believe that if unequal treaties were signed, it was because the Indians weren't sophisticated enough to be able to negotiate a better deal. And I think that one of the points that you make clear in the book, at least in many cases, where is that that was not the case at all, that Native Americans knew full well the difficulties that they faced, did what they could to try to negotiate an agreement that was the best that they could get. But the fact of the matter is that the power relationship between them and the United States was heavily unequal, and that they were at a disadvantage that no amount of sharp negotiating could have done anything about.
Well, that is indeed the way I look at it, and when you go back and really get deeply into Indian history, including the oral tradition that's been handed down, and read the treaty minutes, and there just isn't any question about their sophistication and what they understood and how defiant they were. And, you know, there'd probably never been a negotiation where the parties were exactly equal. And in the case of Indian treaties, in the late 1700s, the tribes had very significant military power, and all the countries, the European countries that were vying for power in the United States, wanted the tribes as allies. And so they had heavy leverage at that time, and we got some really large reservations set up. And even in as late as the 1860s, you had magnificently large reservations set up on the Oregon coast, in western Colorado with the Ute reservations, Sioux country. Those were all tribes that had very strong military capabilities, and the United States was while probably more powerful, it was going to lose a lot of people and spend a lot of money trying to win a war so that there was leverage. 20 years later, that was gone, and in other parts of the country, it was already gone by then. And so, but yeah, I think in as far as I can tell, in almost all cases, the tribes arguably came pretty close to obtaining the maximum deal that they could get, given the power differential between the tribes and the United States. And as time went on, the power differential was really dramatic and resulted in breaking up of some reservations and creating really small reservations and so forth.
We have someone else to talk with here, and this is a caller in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Your question earlier about the later time of the civil rights movement, it struck, reminded me that you mentioned they had different goals, but in one sense, they had something very important in common, which was the enemy, which was the federal government and the FBI. And I'm thinking of Ward Churchill's work in a book called Agents of Repression and Documents of COINTELPRO, where he goes through the both the history of the destabilization and subterfuge against both the American Indian movement and Dr. King and everybody else.
Yeah,
Panthers.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was worthy of note. This termination, I guess I apologize, I haven't been listening. I wonder, what period was that again, and can you go through? You mentioned who was important in it, but I'm struck by, again, something that I bring up from time to time, is that that Lincoln actually modeled a Negro Removal Act on our office on the Indian Removal Act, which is more in the 18... 40s,
yeah,
et cetera. I mean, well, obviously, I'm talking about the Indian Removal Act
yeah.
was passed then. All right, well, I just wanted to point out that that's still not too widely discussed. I guess everybody sort of knows that they were taping Dr. King and embarrassing him and things like that, but they were also doing all manner of sparking internecine battles in the American Indian Movement and all sorts of things like that. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point, and I think tribal leaders were very cognizant of the issues you're talking about with FBI and really other federal agencies to some extent, and police officers at the local level also, and the way that they had targeted black activists, and the tribes saw that coming and tried to learn from it as the blacks were trying to learn from it at the time, and then termination came up in the 50s. You asked the time period of that. That came up in the 50s.
Well, other questions are welcome. We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Charles Wilkinson. He's professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder and is one of the country's leading experts on Indian law, the author of the book Blood Struggle, The Rise of Modern Indian Nations, published in 2005. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit in the beginning about the fact that it seemed like going back to this period where talking about the period where the termination policy was put into effect by Congress in the early 1950s, that at this point that it seemed how clearly stated, I'm not sure, but it seemed that the overall purpose of Indian policy and of the Bureau of Indian Affairs was to get Indians to stop being Indians. And that the Bureau really took its direction here from Congress that had the same kind of idea that a kind of profound assimilation would be what would be best for Native Americans. Given the fact that only 50 years ago that was where we were, can you say something about the Bureau of Indian Affairs today and how its mission has changed and how Native Americans today feel about it?
Well, the main difference, to be serious about the Bureau of Indian Affairs, is that they aren't running the reservations anymore. And they're very much in a support role, and I think that the Bureau is very clear as to who their constituency is and who they're working for, which is the tribes, as well as being federal employees. And again, we went through this repression of cultures, and Sundance at Sioux and dances at Hopi were raided and shut down as late as the early 50s. And today, at a time when tribes are becoming more entrepreneurial, and you have gaming, for example, where you have a very small number of tribes, people becoming rich, and they're all small tribes where that's happening, but where all the gaming tribes are receiving a significant, in terms of, 7 to $12 million or something, I'm thinking is kind of the mean return for gaming tribes that go into tribal government and college scholarships and good health programs and housing and so forth, and also economic development. But at the same time, what we've seen over the last 15 years or so is a really dramatic and I think heartwarming revival of cultural traditions. And so we're seeing really resolute attempts to revive, stabilize, and make permanent tribal languages. And what a thing it is, how difficult it is with the Internet and TV and celebrities and pro athletes, how hard it is for Indian children, young people, to focus on their own cultures and their own languages. But we're really seeing it, and we're seeing a lot of tribal schools and tribal programs. We're seeing a lot of research in tribal colleges. We've got 34 tribal colleges now. that are working on language. And you're seeing old dances coming back. The Zuni runners are back, running 50, 100 miles at a stretch. We're seeing the canoe journey in the Pacific Northwest, where the tribes on both sides of the border historically used to meet and celebrate in the summer, and Canada and the U.S. both cracked down on that, and now those beautiful cedar canoes are back, and I think it's at Macaw this year on our side of the border where we'll have canoe journey. There'll be 10, 15,000 people out there with boats coming in or canoes coming in from 30, 40, 50, 60 tribes. I don't know what the number will be this year. So it's really really inspiring what tribal people have done, you know, particularly considering the most powerful government in the world levying its power on them the way that it did. And still, you still have tribalism, you still have the cultures, and you still have Indian country being a place that really is run according to tribal traditions, tribal priorities for young people and older alike.
Let's see, we get one more call here, and the caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, just quickly, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just making the observation here. What do the people call themselves today? In other words, that term that you're using, Indian, was given by those who thought they were in another place and unfortunately identified the people they saw as Indian.
Yes.
But what do the people call themselves today? And making that observation, what have you come to?
Yes, good question. And first of all, in a sense, the first thing they call themselves is by their own tribe. And so a person may be Lakota, Navajo, may call themselves Diné at Navajo. Number of tribes have eliminated their Anglo names and have adopted traditional tribal names, their old names, for themselves. But then on the question of the grouping, for whatever reason, and what you said is very logical, that maybe tribes would resist, Indian people would resist the use of Indian, but Native American, in other words, with African Americans and previously really blacks for a generation or so, and other ethnic groups, the terminology is really important, but I'm going to say with tribes, it just hasn't become sensitive. And so what you hear in most conversations is people just using the term Indian. And the origins are the wrong origins, but it just doesn't have the edge of sensitivity that it does with other ethnic groups. And so Native American, Indian, American Indian are all accepted, but I think Indian is most commonly used, and I'm including by Indian people.
We have about 2 minutes here. We began talking about how poor conditions were for Native Americans in the early 1950s when the termination policy came into being. You've also talked about the fact that there is a great cultural resurgence among Native Americans. If you take a look at those other indicators, though, of social and economic well-being, and you compare conditions for and lives of Native Americans today, say, with those of 1953, can you say that there has been measurable improvement?
Yes, there's been measurable improvement in every single area. And I say that, take the area of health. Diabetes has really come to the fore in the last decade and is extremely serious right now, and probably more serious than it was in the 50s. But health generally is dramatically improved, life expectancy and so forth. Income levels are terrible right now, and unemployment is terrible. But it was in the 50s 60%, and it's down now under 20%, and that's, you know, the highest in the country. But it's come down, and it's come down by the tribe's own work and their own economic development have been the driving factors. And then you take an area such as alcoholism, which has so long been a serious problem in Indian country, but the tribes themselves are working on it, and the trend continues to be solid improvement in alcoholism. It's slow, but it's been very steady. The improvement has been. So, yes, I'm going to say just whatever indicator you use, there has been progress, but they've had a long road to travel, and there's still a whole lot of road to be traveled, that's for sure. And so I take your point, but without question, the improvement's been top to bottom.
Well, we are going to have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. I want to encourage people, if you're interested in reading more about the subject we're talking about here this morning, that is something about the policy of termination of the 1950s and about how Native Americans organized to respond, and really from that we have the modern tribal sovereignty movement. You can look for the book by our guest. The book is Blood Struggle, The Rise of Modern Indian Nations, published by W.W. Norton. First came out in 2005 and is now available in a paperback edition, also from W.W. Norton, so you can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore. Our guest, Charles Wilkinson, is professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Professor Wilkinson, thank you very much.
Thank you, David, and I appreciate your preparation and interest on the subject.
Very good.